You are attending session 221, titled What the LDS Church Can Learn from the Catholic Response to Fundamentalism. This session is being recorded, and audio will be available for purchase at the Sunstone Audio Desk after the session. So about this session, from 1970 to 1995, Veronica Lucan reported ecstatic visions of Mary, the mother of Jesus. As the visions become more widely reported, Lucan developed a following that culminated in the building of a shrine in Bayside, New York. Her visions reported that the end was near and that a Vatican infiltration caused the Second Vatican Council. Lucan is one of many women whose intense religious experiences led to the resurgences in Catholic traditionalism. However, despite their controversial beliefs and practices, traditionalist Catholics are not always condemned by Catholic leadership. I argue that the lack of, I think Dr. Rossetti argues, I don't think I do. Dr. Rossetti argues that the lack of condemnation benefits the Roman Catholic Church hierarchy and leads to less schism in the Catholic movement, and the LDS Church can learn something from this approach. Sounds intriguing. Sounds very intriguing. Dr. Christina Rossetti has a PhD in religious studies from the University of California, Riverside. Her research focuses on Mormon fundamentalism and the emergence of new movements within a religious tradition. We're very happy to have you with us today, Dr. Rossetti.
All right. They finally let me talk about my people at Sunstone. It's great. It only took me 5 years. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Christina, and I'm Roman Catholic. And I say Roman Catholic very intentionally because, just like we all know, there's more than one way to Mormon, there's also more than one way to Catholic. And we don't talk about that very frequently. And, importantly, I'm a traditionalist Catholic. And traditionalists are our version of fundamentalist. And so for the last 6 years, I spent a long time studying Mormon fundamentalism. And the reason I did that is because Mormon fundamentalism was a safe way of trying to figure out myself. In the same way that we study religion for different reasons, I studied Mormon fundamentalism because it was easy. It was an easy way to talk about fundamentalism that didn't make me have to question my ideas about the world. And so now I finally realize that now that I have my PhD, I can talk about my weird problems. So Catholic fundamentalism. I don't know how much people know about Catholicism in this room, so I want to give a little background on what Catholic traditionalism is. Because much like how the LDS Church calls fundamentalist, Catholics don't really have that term. We call them traditionalist. Catholicism is built on the two pillars of scripture and tradition. That is what it means to believe in Catholicism and to be a Roman Catholic especially. So people who someone might call a fundamentalist, we would call a traditionalist. And this is an image of a traditionalist Catholic church and in the Tridentine tradition. And so we'll talk a little bit about what that means. So as a background, has anyone ever heard of Vatican II? And like know what it is really well. So we have councils in the Roman Catholic Church, and there's not really a Mormon equivalent to that. But they don't happen very often. They don't happen every year. But when councils are called, everyone has to come together, and documents are released that are authoritative to the entire church. And they happen in the Vatican. They happen in Rome. This is what Vatican II looked like. It was fancy. And so in 1959, Pope John XXIII called the Second Vatican Council, and he had this idea that Catholicism was kind of iffy. People weren't as excited about being Roman Catholic as they always had been, and so he wanted a spiritual renewal, and so he called forth this council to talk about the state of the Roman Catholic Church and what the church could do to bring greater lay involvement, so better, bigger involvement with generic Catholic people. And so the council began October 11th, 1962, and it ended 3 years later. Under the leadership of a different pope, John VI. During this time, 16 documents were released from Vatican II that were spanned a variety of issues. So Vatican II stemmed from everything from how we talk about the church. Wasn't going to be as judicial anymore. It was going to be more faith-based. It also changed that the lay people could be more involved. It changed that the Mass was going to be in vernacular now, so it wasn't just in Latin. But there were also some practical changes. Women stopped wearing the veil during Vatican II. There was no formal decree that women had to stop veiling, but women took veils off during Mass. People stopped kneeling for communion after Vatican II. People started taking what Mormons would call the sacrament in their hand rather than on their tongue. So there were changes that happened that were practical and not just theological changes. And most Catholics really accepted this and considered it a modernization and a liberalization of the Roman Catholic Church. But there were definitely people that weren't happy about these changes. So like I mentioned, there were some unintended consequences like the removal of the veil. One of the biggest changes is that priests became significantly more approachable. So like in the first picture I showed with the priest facing backwards, after Vatican II, the Mass was no longer called Tridentine. It became called the Novus Ordo Mass, or the New Order Mass. And priests face people now. So if you go to Mass now in the United States, it's probably in English, and the priest is probably going to look you in the eye during Mass. And that's not how it always was before 1965. And one of the big changes is they got rid of they abolished Friday of Sorrows. So has anyone heard of Good Friday? So Good Friday also used to be the Friday of Sorrows, which wasn't about Jesus. It was about Mary being sad that her son was dying. And so that we removed that. And a lot of people thought that that was a inadvertent removal of Mary's significance. So traditionalists fought back. And so traditionalist Catholicism, we're going to talk about Veronica a lot, but traditionalist responses ranged widely. So when we talk about traditionalist Catholics, they're not one kind of person. So we have everything from what's called sedevacantist Catholics, which are people that don't think there's a pope right now, that the entire Catholic Church is in a state of apostasy, that the seat of Rome is empty, that there is no pope, and therefore there is no valid clergy, all clergy are illicit. And so people who are members of sedevacantist movements will often stay home during church, and they'll pray a rosary, and they'll pray a rosary in the hope that the church will go back in order. It might sound familiar if you're interested in fundamentalism. So this is an example of Our Lady Immaculate Queen. There's actually a sedevacantist church in Ogden that meets in a house on Sunday mornings. Another example is Society of St. Pius X. They have their own clergy because they think that the Roman Catholic clergy is out of order. There's an SSPX church in West Valley that anyone is free to go to. If you're a woman, you do have to veil to go. But then there were other movements that emerged, and one of them was this woman, Veronica Lukin. And so in this presentation, I want to talk about individual traditionalist movements, not mass movements, such as SSPX. So Veronica Lukin was a woman who saw Mary, and that's not weird in Roman Catholicism. Mary appears to a lot of people all the time in the Roman Catholic tradition, in all Catholic traditions, and apparitions of Mary are basically just reported supernatural appearances of her. If you live in Northern California, you've probably seen Our Lady of Guadalupe. Yes, we know who I'm talking about. Like, people get tattoos of her. And she is an apparition that appeared in Mexico, and she is actually the patron saint that watches over all of the Americas. And there's a range of validity. So everyone sees Mary on toast, and the Vatican thinks that's wacky and just doesn't even bother with it. But there are that are considered to be valid, true apparitions of Mary. One of the most significant ones is Our Lady of Fatima, who is pictured right there. And she appeared to these three children in Portugal. And Fatima became a symbol of the traditionalist movement because she added prayers to the rosary. So if you pray a rosary in Roman Catholicism, you are praying prayers that Fatima taught to these children. She also taught that the entirety of Russia would be consecrated to her, that communism would end. She became a symbol of conservative values. And most notably, Pope John Paul II, who most people kind of recognize as a famous pope, he was actually shot the day she appeared to these children, and he credits her with his life. So she became a big symbol of the saving of the papacy to a lot of Roman Catholics. So there's different explanations for these apparitions happening. Of course, there's people who think that there's a spiritual reason why Mary appears, but One of the most compelling reasons is that Mary appears in times of great distress. And Vatican II was one of those times when a lot of traditionalists claimed that Mary was appearing to them and she was going to solve everything. In Roman Catholicism, just so that everyone knows, Mary isn't kind of just Jesus' mom. She's also, we call her the Immaculate Conception. She's the Queen of Heaven. She's everyone's mom. She's a big deal. She's not just Jesus' mom. So, Veronica Lucan was one of these women that after Vatican II, she started seeing Jesus. So she was a Roman Catholic woman, and she was raised, born and raised in Bayside, New York. And she started receiving visions of Mary between 1970 and 1995. She believed, just like most Roman Catholics believe, that anyone can receive insight from heaven, but she was special, that Mary was specifically chose her to help bring the church back in order. So her general idea, so she watched Vatican II happen, and everyone in her congregation removed their veil, and everyone in the congregation started speaking English. And she was greatly distressed by this. And she believed that her church was falling out of order and that the priesthood was going to be lost. And so in the midst of this, while she was sleeping one night, she had a statue of St. Teresa, and her room started smelling like roses. Obviously, I wasn't there. I'm just saying this is what she wrote in her diaries. That her room started smelling like roses, and the statue started speaking to her, that she would be a victim soul, and that she would bring the church back into order. Very similar to Mormon fundamentalist ideas. So in Roman Catholicism, a victim soul is someone who experiences great anguish for the sake of the church. So she never received the stigmata, she never bled profusely or anything like that, but she was constantly ill for her entire life, and most people in her church and in her area thought that that was a sign that she was going to bring the church back into order. And so she started the Bayside movement. And this is what that looked like, tangibly. So this is Veronica later in her life, and she would receive visions. And most of these visions, she saw the great destructions of the end times, and what that looked like to her was the sun coming and hitting the earth, and everyone was going to be destroyed, which actually resembles earlier visions of Mary, especially Our Lady of Fatima, who saw the sun spin. She would take roses, and she would put them into the sky, and Mary would bless them, and then she would hand out all the roses, and people would be healed. And she also would do spirit photography, where people would get to bring a Polaroid camera and take pictures of the shrine, and different things from Our Lady of Fatima would appear. So in this picture, one of the children that spoke to Our Lady of Fatima, her name was written in the sky. And over time, her visions got significantly stranger, for lack of a better word. So she started giving revelations on UFOs, and people considered them authoritative. Once her UFO revelation started, a lot of people in her church started to say that this wasn't acceptable, and they actually asked her to move the little shrine she built to the state park down the street. Especially her priest was like, you need to take your Mary and go. But importantly, she still went to Mass every single Sunday with that priest, and he gave her communion and considered her a faithful Roman Catholic. As her visions got more intense, she became convinced of a Vatican conspiracy, and this is going to sound wild, and I'm going to tell you in advance. She became convinced that during Vatican II, the Pope was actually drugged by Russian communists and put in the basement of the Vatican, and a Russian plastic surgeon created a fake Pope, and he was the one that actually enacted Vatican II. And that sounds silly to a lot of us who are laughing, and when the first time I read that, I was like, Veronica, sweetie. But she believed that ardently. And not only did she believe that, but members of her congregation believed it too. Because in the time that Vatican II was happening, that was a problem. If you're familiar with the Mormon fundamentalist movement, there are changes in the LDS Church that many people consider to be apostate changes. And this was the Vatican II moment was the exact same thing, that these were changes that were too far. And Veronica was going to fix that. And so her solution was to say that the Roman Catholic Church was actually being run by Russian communist spies. Of course, this is happening in the 70s, so people are still worried about communism, but that was her conclusion. So she ends up building a shrine in Bayside, New York, And thousands of people start going to the shrine to receive blessed roses from her. This is the shrine. It is still there. It's in Bayside Park. You can still go to it. And on Sunday, you can still see people praying the rosary. They don't have priests of their own, but they do have priests from New York that will go and say Mass at the shrine who believe it is an authentic apparition of Mary. The Vatican has said no, but there are priests that believe it's authentic. So for many traditionalists, the church was out of order, but they didn't want to necessarily leave because this was their church. So oftentimes, a lot of Mormon fundamentalists will call the LDS church the mother church. And very similar here, Catholicism is diverse, but unlike other groups, the diverse range of Catholics are actually less likely than Protestants to sever and start their own movements because they believe that the Roman Catholic Church is the mother church and the true church, and we can fix it instead of making our own thing. It might sound familiar if you're familiar with Mormon fundamentalism. They also don't split and start their own church because most traditionalist Catholics, if not all, believe that the priesthood and authority is significant and important, and women can't have that. So most women who are receiving revelations from Mary and who are publishing their revelations and gaining a following, most of them do not believe in the ordination of women. So Veronica Lukin actually wrote pretty intensely and significantly on one of the great apostasies being the ordination of women. She wrote a lot on the dangers of ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment. So that was never going to happen. So she started a movement. She had thousands of followers, but she was never going to start her own church because she didn't believe she could. So then, why was she still Roman Catholic? So this is the part that I find particularly interesting, and I think that the LDS Church can potentially learn something like this from this. So Veronica and her followers said they were traditional, not traditionalist. Traditionalist carries a lot of baggage in Roman Catholicism, in most Catholicism, because it means that you're potentially part of a splinter group. And her followers, even though they were doing things considered strange, they would say that they weren't actually anything but Roman Catholic. They identified it as Roman Catholic for their entire life. And they also remain, she and her followers remain devoted to the church. So she's actually buried right now in a Catholic cemetery. For those who don't know, you can't be buried in a Roman Catholic cemetery unless you are a Roman Catholic. And she's buried in one in Bayside, New York. And she had a Catholic funeral, which was a contentious moment because her followers showed up at the funeral and they declared her a saint. They named her Veronica of the Cross. And the church was like, no. But she still got to have her Catholic funeral. So in Roman Catholicism, we have bishops, but they're not like LDS bishops. They are they're kind of like a stake president. That would be the closest equivalent. And her bishop, of course, had a response to Veronica because he watched this woman gain a following. He watched a shrine being built. And so he wrote a very long letter to Veronica. And he said, there's no credibility to what you're seeing. Mary isn't appearing to you. And you're promoting confusion. And that's all he said. So think for a minute, if a member of the LDS Church started receiving revelations saying President Russell M. Nelson is a communist thing, and that the real prophet was buried underground, and I'm the only one that's receiving revelations, and then they gain a following, what would happen? They would probably receive some kind of disciplinary council. If not, they're going to get excommunicated, but bare minimum, disfellowshipped. And people would be told to stay away. But her bishop did something interesting. He said, you're promoting confusion. Mary's not appearing to you, but I'm going to still give you communion. You are a Roman Catholic. And that was it. She got to be a Roman Catholic her whole life. And so my argument to that is the Roman Catholic Church was able to control the narrative through this telling. They were able to say, she's Roman Catholic, but what she's doing is kind of ridiculous. And at the same time, they halted any perpetuation of a narrative that she was persecuted and therefore correct. And so the Roman Catholic Church has been able, historically, to halt the emergence of schismatic groups through this exact method, by not ostracizing them and them forming their own group. So she remained Roman Catholic until the day she died. Her followers still very much identify as Roman Catholic. There's only about 2,000 followers at the Bayside movement today, which doesn't seem like a lot, but it's a lot comparatively. But does this always work? No. And so I recognize that this model of dealing with things doesn't always work. And so I do want to give a counterexample. And the best counterexample that's alive today is Julia Kim. and she is a Roman Catholic woman in South Korea. I'm sorry, the pictures are kind of graphic, and I'm sorry. But Julia Kim is a Roman Catholic woman in South Korea who received ecstatic visions of Mary, and she has a statue that she refers to as Our Lady of Naju, who cries blood all the time. All the time. And she identifies this woman, this statue, as Our Lady of Sorrows, that this Mary is weeping for the sins of a generation of people. And so she carries this statue with her around all the time. And she also, a lot of her followers have started to consider her to be a current incarnation of Blessed Mother Mary. She also does this thing where when the sacrament or the Eucharistic host is put on her tongue, it starts to bleed profusely. And so every time she takes communion, she gets covered in blood. And she considers that to be a Eucharistic miracle, which is something that happens in Roman Catholicism. There are accounts of the host starting to bleed, but it happens in her mouth every time she takes communion. She has also been, she's also claimed to receive the stigmata. And so she does a lot of things like that. And she has also started to claim that the church is out of order. Now, the difference with her is that her bishop did excommunicate her and said, this isn't, you can't bleed everywhere anymore. And mainly because she would go to church and the church would actually be very bloody by the time she would leave Mass. And so her bishop said no more. And not only did her bishop say, you can't do this anymore, her bishop declared that anyone who goes and sees her is automatically excommunicated. No councils needed. You don't have to meet with a priest. If you go and see her, you're not a Roman Catholic anymore. So what do we think that did? Yes. Every year, about 7,500 people make a trip to South Korea to see her and to touch her. And she has become her own movement. So the exact opposite happened. Veronica Lukin's movement every year dies out. So every year we see about 100 people less attend the Bayside Shrine. Every year we see about 1,000 people more make a trip to South Korea to see Julia Kim. So it is a counterexample that the church absolutely does excommunicate people, but it proves the point that when you do that, it grows a movement. So, what are some comparatives that we can draw with Mormonism? So this is still a picture of Bayside. This is what it looks like today. There is always a blue chair for her and for her spirit to get to sit there, even though she is no longer on earth. So they still retain a seat for Veronica of the Cross to go to the shrine every Sunday. And some believe that people are still receiving revelations through her. So Veronica was a woman who taught that the Roman Catholic Church was out of order, in the same way that a lot of Mormon fundamentalists teach that the LDS Church is out of order. That's not unique in religion. She taught that the Roman Catholic Church was in a dire situation, including messages of a false pope and questioning church authority. And she fought conservatism. One of the great interpretations of her is she never experienced hostility, ever. People really loved her, her bishop and her priest loved her, and they let her be Catholic. So the Catholic response ultimately was to let Veronica be Roman Catholic. And in letting her be a Roman Catholic, they were able to control the narrative and stop the emergence of a movement that could have potentially grown and been damaging, much like Julia Kim's. But in letting people identify the way they want and to have a multiplicity of Catholicisms, the church was able to halt that. And so my argument ultimately is that in letting people have more than one way to Mormon, it benefits people generally, but it also benefits the LDS Church institutionally by retaining authority and controlling the narrative. Thank you.
Are you willing to take a lot of questions?
Yes, I know I'm wrong.
We've got plenty of time, so.
Perfect.
So let's use the mic if we can, and I'll put it on this stand here, and if you could ask your questions respectfully, that would be great.
Not a Catholic scholar, just very minor. I've been listening to a podcast called History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra. It's very interesting. Seems to be that there is a long history of schism in the Catholic Church, in all religions, but it seems to me that the case you're making is not that the Catholic Church has taken this approach, but it's the same issue that Mormons and others face of ecclesiastical roulette. Whereas Veronica got an enlightened priest and Kim did not. Can you answer that?
Yeah. So that's fair. Yes, I definitely think that we have ecclesiastical roulette in the same way that the LDS Church has bishop roulette. And that definitely changes things. Julia Kim became a problem because there was so much blood, and that becomes a health concern. So that was something that was unique to her. The Roman Catholic Church doesn't really excommunicate people anymore. Fidel Castro was excommunicated. Fair. A lot of Nazis were excommunicated. But a few years ago, I went on a big campaign to get people to stop paying tithing because of sex abuse, and I told people not to go to confession anymore because of sex abuse. It was in KUER. My priest was like, "Christina, what are you doing?" And it was fine. It was fine. And I go to a cathedral, so I have a very conservative priest. But the Catholic Church doesn't really excommunicate people. When they do excommunicate people, the big difference is that they excommunicate people with authority. They won't excommunicate lay people generally, which is a big difference than the Mormon Church, than the LDS Church, or any Mormon church. So, for example, women who become priests in liberal Catholic sects, the women who become priests are never excommunicated. The priests who ordain them are. So the Catholic Church's problem with authority extends in such a way that lay people are seldom excommunicated. So Julia Kim, I brought up that example because she is a counterpoint to my argument, but it's also a very extreme case in Roman Catholicism. It seldom happens. We have women in Georgia who are receiving the stigmata and claiming the Pope is wrong, and those women will never get excommunicated. So she is a very extreme case, and I think it's because we just don't excommunicate lay people anymore. You have to be like a priest.
I think I might have misunderstood what you said, and I just don't know my Catholic history well enough, but did you say that the rosary started with Fatima?
No, she added a prayer to it.
Oh, okay, because that
is wrong. No, so the rosaries, for those who don't know, it's a series of prayers that Roman Catholics say, and one of the prayers is the Glory Be, and it used to end with the Glory Be, and Fatima told people to start praying the Oh My Jesus. So that was added in 1917 because of Our Lady of Fatima.
So I had a second question.
Yeah.
With the ecclesiastical roulette, if the people in charge of the ones in New York, they have multi-generational Catholics, and they don't have nearly as many generational Catholics in Korea. So if they had different, if those priests and those of those particular women had been switched around, would they have had the same result? Or do you think multi-generational Catholics would have kind of moderated the growing of the cult?
Yeah, I don't think so, only because even in communities where there are multi-generational Catholics, it doesn't mean the priest is multi-generational. So, for example, my priest is a convert, and he's been a priest for 3 months. So he's brand new out of the gate. That's why he was so confused with my don't tithe stance. But with that said, I think the issue still is that Roman Catholics don't excommunicate people for the most part anymore if they are just lay members of the church. You have to try, and even then you're probably not going to. And so regardless, Julia Kim is an anomaly. If she lived in the United States, she probably wouldn't have been, but I don't think that has anything to do with the generational Catholicism. I think it has to do with we just don't do that anymore.
How does the Roman Catholic Church decide which appearances are legitimate and which aren't?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're going to say that because one's real. But the reality is that it's the materialist argument that I think is legitimate is it's based on outcome of the apparition. So the first thing is that the apparition has to stop before anyone will investigate it. So there's an apparition that's happening in Herzegovia, Our Lady of Medjugorje, and people, thousands and thousands of people travel to go see her every day because Our Lady still appears every day. And so the Vatican will not investigate that apparition because it hasn't stopped yet. And so they're not willing to go and investigate. So what happens is after the apparition, and so there are people that have already condemned Medjugorje as a false apparition, but they haven't said you can't go. So once the apparition stops, the Vatican will then send a team of investigators to the apparition site, and they'll investigate the site, and then they'll investigate the people who supposedly saw it, and then they'll investigate the outcome. So the best example of that is Our Lady of Guadalupe, who a lot of people are familiar with. They investigated the person who supposedly saw Mary. The story never changed, but the bigger one is right after her apparition, 5 million people joined the Catholic Church. So it was a great outcome. It was a that materialist argument stands, that was a good outcome that worked in the favor of the church, and there was no negative impact that she caused, and so it made sense to validate that apparition as authentic. Similar with Our Lady of Lourdes. She's a really big one in France. And 3 million people joined the church after her apparition stopped, and people still claim to be healed by going in the water she appeared out of. So they're not going to condemn something that's working in their favor.
You'd mentioned that it very seldom happens that laity would be excommunicated
anymore.
But priests that get it off track will be.
Yeah.
Going back several centuries to the Spanish Inquisition and the Protestant Reformation, things, of course, were quite different then. Could you address key steps in the transition from what existed in the 16th century to what the situation is today?
Yeah, so because I spend so much time with Mormons, a lot of Mormon missionaries ask me why my church doesn't have missionaries anymore. And I always joke that it ends in murder, like at a mass scale. So between the mission project and the Crusades and the Inquisition, it just ends bad when we try to do missionary work. So we just don't do that anymore. And that's fair. So we don't do missionary work, and it's largely because of that. So yes, during the Inquisition particularly, a lot of people died. People weren't excommunicated. People were murdered. And they weren't Roman Catholic that were being killed. So the Spanish Inquisition was largely Jews that were dying. The Crusades were largely Muslims. Catholics have seldom gone to war with themselves. But they did excommunicate people, but again, it was people in authority. So for example, everyone in this picture has been excommunicated by the Roman Catholic Church for claiming a priesthood that is incorrect. For these people have been. The red hats have been excommunicated. So if you're ordaining someone to a false priesthood, in heavy quotes, you'll be excommunicated. But again, SSPX priests, after they're ordained, are seldom excommunicated. And I think that remains the same. In the 16th, 17th century, the Roman Catholic Church was still going to war, but in terms of dealing with their own people, not so much. And the easy answer is Roman Catholicism's too big. It's like, I go to church every Sunday, no one knows who I am. My priest doesn't know my name, and there's just no way to. And I also can go to whatever parish I want. I'm not going to the same ward at the same time with my daughter's principal, who would absolutely know. It's not efficient or effective to excommunicate Catholics because no one will know who you are. So an example of this, Joe Biden, we all know who that is. He came out in support of abortion, and he was supposedly excommunicated because of that stance, because you're not allowed to support abortion in Roman Catholicism. But no one's going to know or care. He can go to church any Sunday he wants and take communion, and it's not going to matter. It's not efficient or effective to excommunicate lay Catholics because there's too many of them, and they can go wherever they want.
Thanks for your presentation. So question, in the LDS Church, there's a really tight top-down control. I served in a couple bishoprics, and there's this handbook of instructions. Is there any kind of papal encyclical or anything like that where, hey, under these circumstances, discipline's mandatory, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so we have a lot of paperwork because we are a very top-down institution. So we have Code of Canon Law, which is our legal proceedings. And so we even have canon lawyers. So once you're a priest, you can go to law school in a Catholic institution, and you can become a canon lawyer. And your entire life is to read canon law. And those draw out the legal proceedings for how the church is to function. And so there definitely are proceedings for excommunication. That is a thing that happens. Papal encyclicals are strange in that encyclicals have a caveat. So an encyclical is a papal decree, basically, on any topic. So Pope Francis wrote one the year after he became pope, and it was on making sure that you like the planet and take care of the environment. And a lot of Catholics actually laughed at that, like that's a really easy encyclical to write. The most well-known encyclical is called the Humanae Vitae, and it was the encyclical that prohibited birth control. But the caveat is that encyclicals aren't infallible. And most people don't recognize that the Pope is actually not infallible. I know I get asked that all the time about my ideas of papal infallibility, and Roman Catholics actually don't believe that. We believe that the Pope is only infallible when they speak what's called ex cathedra, and that's actually really hard to do, and it takes a lot of effort, and the last time it happened was in the 1980s. So it happens once every 50 or so years. So we do have proceedings. But because Catholicism is old and people have kind of figured out the wiggle room, even things like an encyclical, it's very easy for me to support birth control because encyclicals aren't infallible, so it doesn't really matter. Canon law is a little trickier, but who reads canon law? I don't. The canon law books are massive. No one's reading them.
I really enjoyed your presentation, Christina. It was thought-provoking. And I love hearing the comparisons with Catholicism and Mormonism. Your model is scintillating. It is, I think, really quite useful to look at the way in which the institutional response can motivate or cause a social movement. Most of the literature on social movements tends to look at the conditions motivating those in the movement. And you're talking about the institutional framing and how that can make an impact or not. I think it's a little unfortunate that your model sets Catholicism as being rich and complex as against a much more simplistic Mormon response.
Well, I'm not arguing that at all.
But that seems to be the point. And I want to make a counter-argument on that because I think that both sides of your model actually apply to Mormonism. Mm-hmm. When we're aware of excommunicants is when there has been an official response where it's made a lot of press and where it's part of a public movement that is generated around the press, such that it's strongly manifest. There are people excommunicated every day and nobody knows about them.
Right.
The other point is that there are many people who could be excommunicated every day and are not. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of put that under the bishop's roulette argument, but I don't think that's adequate. One of the questions here is when is it that the general authorities get involved and put their power all the way down to the grassroots to try to promote excommunications, as we've seen in some of the most prominent mm-hmm. cases. Not always do the general authorities have success, and I think my case was one. My name's David Knowlton, yeah. Some people may remember. But I think my case is one where they did not have success, in part because of a stake president who simply didn't excommunicate me. Mm-hmm. And as a result, when people aren't excommunicated, it does exactly what you're saying.
Right.
It tends to negate the possibilities of building a movement. Not that I ever wanted to.
Right.
But it negates the possibilities. So I think what you're opening is actually a much more complex way of thinking about Mormonism, and I find that very useful. One other quick little perhaps correction. I'm not so sure Catholics don't missionize today. There are Salesians all over the Amazon who are missionizing.
Yes.
And furthermore, the Andes has been declared a missionaria.
I mean, we have Catholic schools.
Yeah. And, you know, catechism is a kind of missionizing, too, in the way it's done. But that's not where I'm going. They've declared areas of old Catholics, mm-hmm. like in the Andes, have declared the Catholicism inadequate, and they're officially doing missionary work to them. And in the Amazon, they're working with non-Catholics, mm-hmm. and the point is to Catholicize them. So the Catholics have a very long tradition of missionizing, and it is continuing, but it's not like what we see in Mormonism. It requires another sense, another study.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, we have Catholic schools, we have Catholic hospitals. You're going to see a priest and hear about Jesus. And we absolutely do that in different nations. We send priests out everywhere. That is absolutely true. I'm more mean in the Mormon sense of missionary work, of sending out people with a specific purpose to missionize in, especially in the U.S., because I'm talking specifically about the U.S. In terms of excommunication, I know a lot of people who've been excommunicated, and they're now fundamentalist. And that, in my mind, makes sense. I have joked many times that anti-Mormon literature is just fundamentalist pamphlets. And because a lot of people I know read about Adam God on their mission, and then they're like, what's happening here? And a lot of people will get interested, and then they'll get excommunicated, and where are they supposed to go? And they become fundamentalist. And so a lot of my interest in this has been very specifically from friends of mine who I've seen get excommunicated, and it makes sense for them to become fundamentalists, some of which become prophets in their own right.
I quite enjoyed your presentation. I just had a quick question. So you mentioned how the difference between Veronica and, I believe her name is Julia Kim. Mm-hmm. Veronica, it's, I okay,
Julia. Words.
Yeah, so Julia, do you think that if the Catholic Church and her priest or her bishop would, like, go to her now and say, like, just kidding, we'd want to refellowship you, or whatever the terminology is, I'm not quite sure. Do you think that her following would decrease? And do you think, second question, if the LDS Church were to do the same with the fundamentalists and say, like, oh, like, we're actually not going to, like, distance ourselves from you anymore, do you think that would decrease their following? Or do you think, like, that actual time?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think the big thing with Julia Kim, so her problem is she started claiming that she was Mary. That's a big claim. And she's kind of owned that now, so if the church were to reach out to her, she wouldn't join. Like, she's fine being Mary and having a following. And her people are comfortable with that, too. They think that she's an authentic expression of Catholicism, and they don't need the Roman Catholic Church anymore. So that's the big question there is, would they join? And I don't think they would go back. Because Julia Kim, which in a way that all, like, newer religions do, Julia Kim and Our Lady of Nauju fill a need that the Roman Catholic Church is not providing people. She's offering an experience that the Roman Catholic Church can't give people, which is an ecstatic experience that is just not part of contemporary Roman Catholicism. In terms of Mormon fundamentalists, again, I think the answer is no, for some people. If the LDS Church reached out to some people who've been excommunicated, would they join again? Yes, absolutely. But in terms of people who specifically then go out and join a Mormon fundamentalist movement, the problem at that point isn't with having been disciplined. The problem is that they now think that the LDS Church is out of order, and that's a big thing to fix once someone thinks you're an apostate.
Okay, thank you. So.
There's actually a joke about infallibility in Catholics. And it goes like, you know, the Pope claims to be infallible, but there's no Catholic that believes it. Yeah. The Mormons, on the other hand, don't claim to be infallible, but every active Mormon believes that their leaders are infallible.
I think what I've found to be true is my church and me have never claimed the Pope to be infallible, but a lot of Mormons have told me my Pope is infallible. And no one I know who's Catholic has ever believed that. But every time I talk to a Mormon missionary, they ask me about my infallible Pope. And I'm like, that's nothing. Yeah. So,
you know, what I really wanted to make is a comment. Just a few years ago, when we were doing a lot of ordained women things here at Sunstone, there was a lady from Canada that had been ordained a priest, and she claimed that she'd been excommunicated, and she was very proud of it. So they must excommunicate lay people, but it's probably not very common.
No, so we have what's called automatic excommunication in the Roman Catholic Church, where there's certain things that you can do that automatically excommunicate you technically, but it's not a formal excommunication. So you're not going to be called into a priest's office, a bishop's not going to call you in, you're certainly never going to meet with a cardinal or the Pope for a formal proceeding. But we do have things that are automatic excommunication, which are more temporary. So easy things like if you get an abortion, the church claims that you're automatically excommunicated. So if you're ordained, you're automatically excommunicated. Does that mean you can't come back? No. And does that mean that it was a formal proceeding that ensures that that's how it is forever? No. So we have different kinds of excommunication, and that would most likely be what she was referring to. Again, I don't know her. But automatic excommunication and a formal disciplined excommunication are different in Roman Catholicism.
So you can be excommunicated, but not really excommunicated.
So someone who, like, let's say someone, I mean, I'm not making, like, a pro-life or pro-choice stance. I'm just, it's an easy example. If you receive an abortion in the Roman Catholic Church, they would say that you are automatically excommunicated, and therefore you are barred from receiving communion. But who would know that? And so that person can easily walk down the street and go to a different Catholic church and receive communion, and no one will ever know. Just like if she doesn't go to confession, no one's ever going to know that she did this. And so automatic excommunications are sticky because only really you know that you've been excommunicated, and you can choose to accept that or not.
That satisfies me.
Because that person can easily be like, well, I'm not really excommunicated. I'm just going to go to Mass at a different parish now.
I once held what I now perceive to be a naive belief that personal revelation was a uniquely Mormon principle, at least within the realm of Christianity. But in your presentation, there were numerous examples of personal revelation, and it would seem to me that personal revelation is fairly common in the day-to-day lives of Roman Catholics. And I was wondering if you could make any distinctions between the difference between personal revelation mm-hmm. in the LDS Church and in Roman Catholicism and how it operates on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so, I mean, people pray in most Christian traditions, people think they're receiving answers to prayers in most Christian traditions, and you can claim that that's personal revelation. Whether you're Mormon or Catholic, that's what's happening. At a grander scale, Veronica was very much claiming that she was receiving from Mary insight into the state of the United States, and that was just for her. So I would say, personal revelation in Mormonism and Catholicism are the same thing. The difference is whether it is, just like Mormonism, whether it's authoritative for the entire church. So in Veronica's case, her revelations were definitely not authoritative for the entire church. The only person that can do that is the Pope, similar to President Russell Nelson in the LDS context. The last time the Pope ever did that was in 1989, where he formally created the doctrine of the Assumption of Mary, which is the Roman Catholic doctrine that Mary never died, that she was assumed bodily into heaven, and he had this revelation. It was formally declared a doctrine, and now we're all required to go to church in August to celebrate it on August 16th. So it became a formal holiday that all Roman Catholics have to observe. In the United States, it's a day of obligation. So personal revelation is very common, but revelation for the entire church is actually very rare. So that's a difference in Roman Catholicism and Mormonism, whereas Mormonism, you know, every general conference, people receive revelation and they're told changes, whether you think they're policy or revelation or doctrine for the whole church. In Roman Catholicism, it's very rare, once every 50-something years.
Thank you for coming and educating us on this. I've never heard it before, and I think it's just wonderful, and I think the Mormons can learn something because the Catholic Church has lasted so long. It makes you wonder what we're afraid of.
We're just really old and have a lot of money.
Hello. I'm also Catholic. So this is not going to be a Mormon question at all. In comparison to particularly women, but Catholics in the past that have had strange things happen to them, and whether it's the church institutionally or Catholicism socially and culturally, saying, oh, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. And then 100, 200, 300 years later, they're canonized and saints and venerated by our people. Obviously, Julia Kim is probably not ever going to be canonized.
Never
no matter
say
how,
never.
I said more than likely. Anyway, despite her large following, would like say that there's maybe like a more conservative mm-hmm. movement that happens in the church globally, and Veronica gets an uptick or whatever. She could be canonized through her visions, even though they weren't accepted at the time?
Yeah, so, I mean, canonization's rough in Catholicism. We don't do it very often. and the people that are getting canonized today So our most recent canonization was John 7, who did Humanae Vitae, which was rough for a lot of liberal Catholics, and also Oscar Romero, who was considered a martyr for his political work and his he was a communist for his communist work. So it was an interesting canonization moment where a political communist and one of the most conservative Catholics who ever lived were canonized at the same time. For those who don't know, to be canonized as a saint in the Roman Catholic Church, there's different options. If you die a martyr, you can become a saint. There's actually Protestants who become saints for their martyrdom in Roman Catholicism. It's super rare. But the other one is you have to have miracles in life, but you also have to have miracles in death, and they have to be approved by the Vatican. The problem with Veronica's visions is that they've already been formally condemned. So there are apparitions of Mary and visions that aren't formally condemned, and they're not authenticated. They're kind of left in the middle. If her revelations had been kind of left in the middle and in either or, maybe if someone's healed by her shrine, but because it was formally condemned in life, the odds of them revoking a condemnation, that never happens. So that's why I would say no, is because she has formally been hyper-condemned.
Any other questions?
Yay.
Oh.
I thought I was done.
Okay. I was just curious if you could elaborate on the parallels of traditional versus traditionalist in the Catholic context
sense?
And the Mormon context.
You mean in the fundamentalist in Mormon?
Well, I guess, distinguishing. I don't know if you can. Yeah, fundamentalist is the term usually used
for Mormon.
Mormonism, but is there a parallel or a comparative?
Yeah, I mean, both Catholic traditionalists and Mormon fundamentalists are drawing claims to authenticity and being the authentic expression of that faith, and most of them are doing them through the harnessing of historic memory, and so they're claiming that theirs are legitimate based on the historicity of their claim. And so I think like traditionalists and fundamentalists are similar in that they're both claiming an being the authentic, truthful expression. The key difference is that in Mormon fundamentalism, there is continuing revelation in a way that traditionalist Catholics aren't doing. So traditionalist Catholics maintain their traditionalist stance by ending at a certain point, where Mormon fundamentalists then continue to add on to the doctrines. So most traditionalist Catholic sects that have created entire churches, they're not creating new doctrines. They're very much saying that there is no pope, this is over, we're just waiting it out until the millennium, and just like this, whereas fundamentalism then takes the old and then adds on to it. So that's like the key difference, I would say.
Yeah. Yes, I'm wondering if you've ever thought about your model of these two examples in terms of the Great Schism, and if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so the Great Schism was between the Orthodox and the Catholic Church, before the Catholic Church was actually called Roman Catholic. It was just the Catholic and the Orthodox. I haven't, only because I'm a weird Catholic, and I would say both of those are both the Orthodox and the Catholic position were valid. The Orthodox and the Catholic Church split over the Nicene Creed and whether there should be these three extra words. The entirety of Christendom split over three words. And I don't necessarily think so, just because it was a mutual, it's not a mutual break ever, but one wasn't claiming direct apostasy necessarily. I think traditionalist claims of apostasy in Roman Catholicism, they're not new, but it's a different, it's the claims are different than they were during 1045 AD.
Well, thank you so much, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Dr. Christina Rossetti, for your group.